Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and you know, it's time for another Larry Mueller Show book club presentation for you. Just to review, six times a year, we select a book. Actually, we do it at the beginning of the year. We select six books. And our criteria is that it has to be a Wisconsin author or an author who writes maybe a novel set in Wisconsin, or both. Both a Wisconsin author who sets his or her story in Wisconsin. And we have that today in the novel Beyond the Flames. And author and retired Milwaukee firefighter Greg Lee Rents with us today. He takes readers into a it's a world of violent rival gang members a bit. A fire, of course, corrupt politician. But there's everyday heroes, first responders, social workers for you to root for in the book. And if you've read Greg's book, I hope you'll let us know what you think about it. If you haven't, that's okay. There'll be plenty of questions for you as you go along. Thoughts on some of the themes. Greg's got a number of themes in the book, and we'll talk about those themes as we go along. Maybe you're just interested in how to become a writer that gets published. Join the conversation. You can give a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Greg, thank you for joining us today. I should say call you by your full name, Gregory.
Greg is fine.
Greg, okay, yep. Greg's fine. Yep. Thanks a lot for joining us once again.
Oh, this is a real treat. Oh, man.
Well, I tell you what, you retired from a 28-year career as a Milwaukee firefighter. And all right. Since 2019... you've published two novels about Milwaukee firefighters. First of all, somebody wanted to know, I wonder how autobiographical these books are.
So, yeah, the first one is, a lot of it's taken from my personal experiences. And, you know, there's thing about the fire service is the storytelling is really ingrained in the culture of the fire service. So I worked with fellas that could just tell stories all day long, and they were just gifted that way. You know, some of them probably couldn't write a proper sentence, but, man, you know, oral storytelling, oh, my gosh, phenomenal. So I took stuff from them and from some of my experiences. And one of the things that I do have to mention, and my wife always likes me to make mention of that when I talk about it based upon my personal experiences, is that in the first book, the firehouse sex scene was not based on any real personal experiences. Okay. Totally fictionalized.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. And I'm pretty sure there's quite a few scenes in the latest novel that are definitely not based on experiences. Some of them pretty graphic.
Yeah.
At times.
The second novel was actually, I think, more challenging to write because I wasn't leaning on a lot of personal experiences with that. So I really had to come up with the scenes and the plot points and everything that goes into a novel. And I should mention, too, it's like that second book, I really made a mistake on waiting to write it, because after the first book came out, you know, I was doing all these talks and really enjoying doing appearances and everything. So the mistake I made was I did not write for 2 years. Now, I had spent 10 years writing the first book, and that was going to conferences, workshops, courses at UW, Madison here, you know, learning the craft, because when you retire, I didn't know anything about creative writing, and I was a captain on a fire department, so I wrote fire reports and EMS reports, and those aren't supposed to be very fictionalized. They kind of frown on that. So I spent, you know, 10 years working up to that and hopefully learning the craft. And I'm glad I took my time, because Beneath the Flames was my first book, and it did very, very well. People loved it. They loved the characters, everything about it. But I really got caught up in marketing and promotion and didn't write for 2 years. So when it got to the point where...
Starting all over again, kind of.
Exactly. And it's like, man, oh, man. I when I got to my writing desk, I was terrified because I thought, I don't know how to do this anymore. And, you know, I had imposter syndrome because I thought the first one did so well. And I, can I even do this again? It took me several months before I really started feeling like I could do it again. It was really a challenge. So for any other writers out there, don't take 2 years off between books.
Well, you know what? TK and Genesee Depot has something. It kind of, I think, relates to this. Let's get him, let's get TK involved. TK, thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you, Larry, and thank you, Greg. Greg, I've enjoyed your book so much. Congratulations on the success with them.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
I have two questions for you. First, and you probably kind of answered that, where do you get your inspiration, number one? And number two, what advice do you have for authors who might also want to write a novel?
I think, you know, first of all, it's, you know, for me, I've drawn on a lot of my past experiences. And we'll talk about the book I'm working on now, which, again, draws on past experiences. But, you know, I think most of us writers are observers. So it doesn't have to be your own experiences. I think, you know, when we're out and about, I know I have a little notepad and some people use their phones. If they hear a conversation, I mean, you're kind of listening to people and there is something that, whoa, that's really a good turn of a phrase. You know, I'll write that down. I know in my first book, when I was searching for characterizations of some of the characters, one of the little girls, I was trying to figure out, what does she look like? And I was actually at the Overture Center, and there was a crowd there, and this little girl goes by me, and I think, that's Alexis. Oh, my gosh, there she is. So I quickly wrote down the full description of what that little girl was, and that description really resonated with people. So I think it's just being an observer, and, you know, if you're really serious about writing, you do have to study the craft. And whether you take courses or there's tons of books out there you can read on the craft. I think I've got about 65 or 70 books on the craft of fiction writing, and I keep getting
more.
Do
you have a favorite?
I would say Donald Moss is probably my favorite writer when he's, you know, like his book, Writing 21st Century Fiction. That was the one I think that carried me through my first novel. The things that he points out, basically it's one of these things where you're almost writing cinematically. He said, to keep the reader's interest, you really have to make sure there's tension on almost every page. So as you're writing, it's like, well, this is usually in revision, but after I've written a scene or a couple of scenes, I'll go back and where can I ramp up the tension in this scene, whether it be through dialogue, some kind of even just an action of some sort. So you're constantly searching for ways to ramp it up to keep the reader turning the page. And that's what Donald Moss calls that micro-tension. It's not the tension of the entire storyline, but what's happening right now on that page that you have to turn the page to the next one. And can you put something on that page to make sure that reader has to turn the page? So I'm constantly looking at that, and I think that was some of the best advice I got. So, yeah, Donald Moss, any of his books on writing fiction, I think are phenomenal.
And you also... I think you mentioned in passing, you did some writer's workshop kinds of things too, did you not?
I did. So not only workshops, but I took courses at UW Continuing Studies here before they terminated the whole program in writing, which is really sad. But yeah, I went, since I kind of got to this gig late, I thought, you know, I'm going to go to these conferences and workshops. And one of the best pieces of advice I got was a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist, Robert Olin Butler. And I was at a conference down there and talking with agents and editors from New York. Mm-hmm. And they kind of made me feel bad because they were telling me pretty much I had to rewrite the novel I'd written. Mm-hmm. And I had worked on that thing for 10 years. It had gone through four professional editors, and everybody was gushing about it. And it's like, they really wanted me to take out some of the emotional aspect of that first novel, change settings. Mm-hmm. So when I got to see Robert Olin Butler, he was in a separate house from all the others. And when I walked in there, he gave me the best advice ever. He said, I've read your work. He said, I can tell you're writing from something deep inside. He said, he calls it the white hot center. And he said, you're a good writer. He said, I would actually say you're an excellent writer. I love what you're writing. He says, don't listen to those people over in that other house. Those agents and editors are going to talk you out of writing from that white hot center and have you writing more of a commercialized fiction, which I don't think that's what you want to write. So, yeah, I mean, you get advice left and right. You should do this. You shouldn't do that. So in the first book, a lot of it takes place in rural Wisconsin. And it takes a young farmer and plops him in the inner city of Milwaukee as a young firefighter. And the agents all wanted me to get rid of the whole rural part of the story. And so when I went on my book tour after, you know, I turned down a number of agents actually for that. When I went on the book tour, when I shared that story, I couldn't tell you how many people said, are you kidding? They wanted you to cut that? Those are my favorite parts of the story. In fact, there's a fire in there. At one of the book talks, this farmer came up and he said, I read your book. He said, it really tore me up. I said, what part of it? Because now there's people, you know, there's some tragedy in there, some serious tragedy. He says, oh, when that combine burned up, it just tore me apart. I thought, wow, people do see different things.
Well, the price of a combine to a farmer.
that was serious for him, absolutely.
Oh, man.
No doubt.
TK, thanks a lot for calling. Let's take a call from Nathan in Madison. Nathan, hi.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Greg. I wanted to ask you if you had read a recent book called Behind the Maltese Cross.
I have not. No. It seems to me somebody mentioned it.
It's another fire book. Or fire related.
Okay.
Yes. Actually, it was written by my cousin, and it's based on the stories of firefighters that she interviewed in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. And in fact, two of her brothers, one was a fire chief in Massachusetts and the other was a captain in New Hampshire. And they got her access. And so it's all, everything in it is through life stuff. And it's pretty well written for her first book.
What's the title of it again?
Behind the Maltese Cross.
Behind the Maltese Cross. Okay.
Right. I don't know how many people actually know that the Maltese Cross is the symbol of firefighters.
Yeah. Nathan, thanks a lot for calling. The Maltese Cross. Well, you're writing down the book. I see you're writing the book title down.
I am. I got to check it out. I love reading other firefighter stories, and you always learn something. There's no doubt.
Yeah. The Maltese Cross, the symbol of the firefighters.
Right. Yeah.
Nathan, thanks again. Janine in Manitowoc, we'll go to you. Hi, Janine.
Hi there. I have a question for you. Do you miss firefighting EMS? And if so, is it like the dark humor, the camaraderie, patience, all of it? Or don't you miss it at all?
I do miss it. There is a part of it. It's like it's such a close-knit community. It is your second family. I mean, we work sometimes 24 on and 48 off, sometimes 48 on and 24 off. So you're with these people for long periods of time. We get to know each other intimately. This is our second family. We share stuff that we probably shouldn't share with each other sometimes. Mm-hmm. but yeah, that part of it, it's like the kitchen table in the morning is an incredible place at every firehouse throughout the country. When we start out today, we take care of the rigs and get everything squared away before we go to the kitchen table to make sure we're ready for the run, get ourselves all set up. And then most firehouses from, at least in Milwaukee, and I've talked to others, from like 8 till 9, that's our time where we BS and we get whatever out. And interestingly enough, not too many things are off the table in those discussions, and they can get really serious. And man, oh man, it's you know, it's such a unique environment that when you retire, it's hard to fill that. And you know, you think
all those conversations.
Oh my gosh, yes. I mean, just you know, it could be you know, just conversations about life. And I used to have to, when I was an officer, warn the young guys about sharing too much because the older guys would pump them for information. And now these, down the road, these old timers would use that against the young guys to work on them. And they'd get them telling them, you know, the young guys talking about their wives and their families and what's going on. And then, of course, you have a party, and then there's the wife and these old-timers.
are talking to the wife, and you know what your husband said? kind of thing. Okay.
Yeah. So I always told him, you kind of hold some things back. That's it. So, yeah, I miss that. The adrenaline rush of going to fires, and especially as, say, an officer, you're making those split-second life-and-death decisions. Problem with that is you don't always get good information, so some of those decisions you make don't turn out, and now you have to live with that. And some of us don't do well with living with our decisions that don't turn out well. And especially after writing the first book and doing a tour, it's like I had a lot of first responders come up to me and share their stories of PTSD and things they're dealing with. Some saying, one fella is like, I haven't slept through the night in 20 years. He said, I keep waking up to this one incident. And now you think about it, especially in an inner city fire company, you're going to have 20, maybe 30 runs in a day. And you might have a couple of really major incidents, a house fire, a P&B, somebody dying of a heart attack that you're treating, car crashes that can be just incredibly, incredibly traumatic. And you think about that, you have 20 to 30 runs a day, and you have a couple of major incidents, and now you got to process every single one of those. And some of those aren't going to leave you. And so that part of it, I don't miss, the excitement of, and I was on most of my career, I was on a company with the JAWS unit. So we went to a lot of accidents. And some of them were pretty, pretty tragic where it's like, people die and it's like you work your butt off to get them out of the car, but you can't get them out in time and stuff like that. So it was exciting, but, as you get older, excitement can be highly overrated.
Our guest today, Gregory Lee Renz, R-E-N-Z, that's spelled. And his book is Beyond the Flames, a novel. We haven't even gotten to talking about the novel yet, but we will. And you can. I hope you'll join in with your questions as we move along today. You can reach us. We have great calls already. What about you? You've got a call, a question, or comment? Join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can email us. I see we have a couple of emails as well that are good ones. Email address talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Our Larry Mueller Show book club book for this time around is titled Beyond the Flames. The author, Gregory Lee Renz. Greg with us today in the studio, and he's here to answer your questions and to talk about the book. And once again, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Greg, you told me before the show you were saying, I asked about stories, and you said, I could tell a story from my own personal experience. You want to pick one out and tell us.
Okay, sure. So actually, in a way, this is kind of an important story because I had to share this story at some awards banquets. And the first one I shared this at, I told this story. And it's like when I saw the reaction of the crowd, that's when I really had the epiphany that, man, if I could learn how to do that on the page, what a fabulous thing that would be, because I tell people really moved by it. So hopefully this comes across as well. So, yeah, this was quite a few years ago, I think 2006. Anyway, I was a captain on Engine 24 in Milwaukee. We got a call for a house fire, like 2 o'clock in the morning. And it's about second week in December. It's sleeting out. And we're going to be the first fire engine on scene. There's also probably going to be a chief there, probably around our arrival. But we'll be the first fire engine on scene. So we pull out of quarters, and we're on the way. And we get a lot of fire calls. A lot of them are false alarms, so we don't get that excited. But we still take a lot of pride in getting out of the barn really fast. So we're out of the barn in like 30 seconds, and we're flying down the road, slipping and sliding on the sleet. It's sleeting out. And then about halfway there, the dispatcher comes on the rig radio and says, engine 24, be advised, there's a report of a smoke in the area, and we have a report of two children trapped in a burning basement at this location. So now the adrenaline kicks up, even with 25 years in the job. It's like, okay, come on, I got to think about this. And I'm going to be the first fire engine on scene, which means I got to make some really quick
life decisions.
Decisions, exactly. So I'm kind of going through basement fire techniques. And basement fires are inherently hard to fight because there's no ventilation, and all that smoke and heat's going to come up the stairwell, which you got to crawl down through. So that's kind of the background. I'm thinking about that. I've got a veteran crew, a veteran driver. Turn onto North 67th Street, and the entire street is loaded with smoke from the moisture in the air, atmospheric inversion. So we can't tell which house is on fire. So we're edging down the street trying to find it, and if we don't go fast enough, there's two children trapped in a burning basement. Obviously, they're not going to make it if we don't get there in time. But if we go by the house and have to circle around, same thing. So kind of caught in between. So we get about halfway down the street, and my veteran driver said, "It's got to be right around in here, boss." And just as you said that, this lady comes running out of the smoke. She's got a gown on that's full of soot, and you can tell, oh, she's been in the fire. And she's screaming, "There's two boys trapped in the basement. Please, please, please hurry." So I'm going to run to the back of the house and make those split-second decisions and see how we're going to go about rescuing them and putting out the fire. So we get to the back of the house, and my two firefighters, they fought hundreds of fire. I didn't have to give them an order. They're going to grab hose line and haul it to the back of the house. So get to the back of the house, and my stomach clenches because I see that thick black smoke just pouring out of the basement. There's no chance in my mind that those boys could be alive down there. But just as I thought that, this lady hollers. She said, "Those two boys was calling for help right before you got here, sir. Please don't let them die. They all I got." So I did everything wrong here. You're not supposed to go into a burning building alone. You should have a charged hose line in case the whole place goes up. But when she said that, I knew that I had to get down there. So I put on my mask. I've got fresh air. I slid down the basement stairs, and I called out their names. It's pitch black. Can't see a thing down there. And I called out their names, Brenton and Brandon, and there was no sign of life anywhere. All I heard was a crackle of fire. And so I'm going to go into search and rescue mode. I wasn't going to leave without them, so I'm going to go straight to the back wall and kind of work from the back wall and work my way around the basement. Before I get to the back wall, I come to a bed, which is a good thing because that's where these kids, well, they'll hide from the fire, get under the covers because they're panicking. They can't breathe. And so get to the bed, and I start rifling through the blankets and flipping the mattress over, and I'm not finding them. And I'm letting out a pretty good line of cusses right now because I'm frustrated. I want to find those boys. If they've got a chance, I got to get them out now. Well, I work my way to the foot of the bed and come to like a pile of clothing, what feels like old clothing and bedding and stuff, and I start rifling through that, and I find what feels like a large rag doll, limp, lifeless, nothing. Pick him up, and I bring his face up to my face piece, and I'm looking into the serene face of what I know is a dead child. So my company's coming down the stairs, so I make my way, follow their voice, and hand them off, get back to the foot of the bed, and I find a much smaller rag doll in that pile of clothing. And same thing, limp, lifeless, and it's like, it just tears your heart out. So I make my way back to the stairway, and other companies coming down. Now we've got more companies on scene. And we fight the fire, and I'm not thinking about the boys. And we're fighting the fire, and when about 45 minutes into this, the fire's out. We've ripped all the walls and ceilings apart in the basement to make sure there's no hidden fire. And now we're going to go outside because and that's when I start thinking about the two boys. It's like, oh, man, I know what I'm going to see. Two little bodies covered by bright yellow plastic sheets. Emmy's going to be there. Police are going to be taking, statements from the neighbors, and the family's just going to be just wailing. It's just a horrible scene. So heading up the stairs, turn to the side yard, and I'm confused. It's like, where did they take the boys? There was nothing there. The yard was empty. It's like, holy, I'm trying to process this. And as I'm trying to process it, the battalion chief, Tom Jones, comes running across the lawn and says, Engine 24, amazing job. Both those boys were resuscitated on scene. They're on the way to the hospital. They're conscious and breathing on their own.
Wow.
Bang. I'll tell you what, never, there's no feeling like that. Well, I don't even think catching the winning touchdown in the Super Bowl would feel that good, but I've never caught the winning touchdown in the Super Bowl. So,
I tell you what, and you know, you just told a wonderful story, and you convey that. You do a good job of conveying those kinds of stories in your book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And it's... talk about... Basically, give our listeners, who haven't read the book yet, a synopsis.
Okay, so Beyond the Flames is about a aging fire captain. I don't think that was me, but anyway, he's at the end of his career, and he's dealing with a lot of traumatic issues. He was a Vietnam War veteran. He was a Marine Force Recon Unit. He was a real tough guy. Things happened over in Vietnam that he's still living with, and in the story he suffers a lot of betrayal in Beyond the Flames by a best friend, even a little friend when he was growing up. So you've got a character, and this is what I really wanted to explore in this book, was the issues of trauma on first responders. And what do we do when we get to that point? So you've got this older captain who is basically suffering from PTSD, and he's pushing everybody away. So nobody likes him, and that's the way he wants it, because that way he can't let anybody in. He's been betrayed, and people that he loved have betrayed him. And so it's like, and with the PTSD, that's what happens too. You just want to separate yourself. At least that's from what I've heard from people that have suffered from that. And you just don't want to interact. So I wrote a book about an unlikable character initially, which is a challenge to keep the reader reading. So I had to build empathy early on in the story so you keep reading. And so this captain who's really doesn't want anything to do with anybody, and you know, he's on the edge of not making it. And what pulls him back into life is he rescues a little girl from a school fire. And this little girl will not leave him alone because she wants to thank him. So she's showing up at his house with cookies and cleaning his house and doing all this stuff for him and badgering him. And finally, he starts letting her in. And then he finds out the tragedies that her family is dealing with and dedicates himself to helping that family come through their horrific situation where they're being basically harassed by the motorcycle gang in town. And, things definitely, there's gang wars going on.
There's a lot more that comes from it, but... I want to go back that part of it, that concept of tragic responses that never go away. You talked about that in your first book a bit, but you heard from after that out doing talks.
Right.
You heard from a number of first responders and military folks.
I did. Yeah, and it actually, I really wasn't planning on writing the second firefighting book. Actually, the book I wanted to write is the one I'm writing now. But talking with the first responders, a lot of them said, thank you for writing a story that shows what our job is really like, not the dramatized Hollywood version, but the trauma we experience and the thing and how we deal with it and how it affects us. And I was on a podcast from this writer in Texas who was also a retired firefighter. And, you know, we started talking books and writing first. And then he started talking about his issues with PTSD. And he said, you know, I almost lost my life to PTSD. He said, I was spiraling. He talked about, you know, an incident in the fire department. And he said, I went for, you know, the talk therapy. And he said, that kind of worked for a while, you know, psychoanalysis or whatever. But he said, my brother died and I spiraled. And he said, I was close to losing it. I was losing my marriage. I was getting just losing all hope. And a friend of mine told me, yeah, go to, and I don't remember what university it was now. That talk was a few years ago. But one of the universities was doing work with EMDR therapy for post-traumatic stress. And so he went and he did that. And he said, Greg, it saved my life. And so I started sharing that at my book talks after that. And I couldn't tell you how many people came up to me and said, you know, that therapy saved me too. And I thought, whoa, this is something that needs to get out there because I had never heard of it before. And I thought, EMDR, eye movement desensitization reprogramming. And more I looked into it, I was like, holy cow, this really does save lives. So I got a hold of a therapist down in New Orleans that does it, and she consulted on the book with me to make sure that I didn't screw up how this stuff works.
It's really interesting.
So, that, and there were so many readers from the first book that just loved the characters in the first book and just pleaded with me to bring them back. So I thought, you know what? There's so much going on here. I really do need to write this second book. And the dive deep into, the darkness of what it really feels like. Hopefully I portrayed that halfway well. You know, it's a hard thing to really put on paper, but, just the journey and then giving hope that there are resources out there. I thought this is the power of fiction because it really brings it home that there's something that might save your life out there that having not read the book, you may not know about.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, Joan in Eau Claire has sort of a procedural type question, I believe. Joan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, guys. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Joan.
If you could, what are your criteria in deciding to turn down an agent or an agency's offer? And also, if you could, what's the technique in creating or crafting an unlikable character or protagonist? And thanks a lot.
Oh, sure. So, yeah, to go back, when I finished the manuscript on my first novel, I mean, the whole idea was to get a New York agent, sell them to the Big Five, and become a New York Times bestseller, right? I mean, that's the dream. So, and like I said, the book had gone through four professional editors, which is, again, is kind of, but I wanted, my mentors at the UW said, this is really an important story about race. Please make sure you take your time and do it right. So I really wanted to engage the readers in the life of, the inner city residents and inner city firefighters. So I worked really hard with it. And it's like, so by the time I was looking for an agent, I was quite certain that, everybody, the editors were always telling me, no, this is ready for prime time. It's ready to go, And then I started hearing from agents that it's like, well, we need to get rid of the rural aspect of the story, and we need to do this. And it's like, I wasn't feeling good about that. That's not the story I wrote. And so I did send out like 90 queries, and I got close to 90 rejections, which is pretty common in this business. But I got some offers of representation. But by this time, I'd talked to the Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and so I was a little more confident in the story and what I wanted to write and what I wanted to publish. And the agents that offered me representation, one of them called me, which doesn't happen either, called me on the phone and said, I want to sign you to a contract. I'm going to send you a contract this afternoon. And I'd been to enough conferences and workshops to understand that this agent-author relationship is kind of like a marriage. It might start out real nice and rosy, but it can go dark also. That's not my marriage. My marriage is just fine. but sometimes they do turn. So it's like you got to really make sure when you sign with that agent that it's right for you. So I the one agent, I was on the phone, I think, for I don't know how many hours at different times. And he's telling me I have to do this and I have to do that. And I'm trying to convince him that, well, what if we do this? And finally I got to the end and I thought, no, I'm turning you down. He says, well, you're making a big mistake. And I said, well, maybe I am, but I can't do what you're asking me to do. And there again, like I said before, the stuff that he wanted me to change in the novel were some of the most loved scenes in the book.
Yeah.
So to me, it's like I...
Well, you did find somebody.
I ended up selling it traditionally to a smaller publisher.
Yeah.
And that was at the suggestion of my mentor at the UW. Said, well, when you get tired of, going through the agents, You can still sign a traditional contract where you get an advance and, you know, you get royalties and all that. There's, you know, middle of the road publishers that'll do that. You don't need an agent. And I know one in Milwaukee that would love to publish your book. So on her recommendation, Henschel House picked up my book and published it, and the rest is...
did pretty darn well.
it did very well. And what was the second question, though?
Well, the second had to do with...
writing an unlikable character?
Yeah, writing an unlikable character.
Okay, so, yeah, I mean, there was no way to write a real likable character with PTSD because that wouldn't be authentic. Most people with PTSD are, you know, they're angry at the world. So to make it authentic, I had to make... So what you have to do is, early on, you have to build empathy. And that was the whole idea of the first chapter, whereas Lee Garrison is a young kid, as a first grader, almost burns his house down. And his best friend turns on him. And then, of course, his father abuses him for nearly burning down the house. So right away, it's like you're kind of feeling sorry for him. So as you show some of his negative behavior, toxic behavior, like to his crew and stuff, you also have to filter in some of the heroic things, you know, him risking his life and doing things. So you're constantly balancing that. I mean, if you just showed an unlikable character with all bad characteristics, who's going to stick with that?
Yeah. So you have him, and you do. You have him saving a young girl, as you were talking about, and many other things as well. Well, let's go to Barbara in Caledonia, Minnesota. She has something for us. Barbara, are you there?
This is Barbara.
Yeah,
yes,
hi.
I am. Hi. Just published in June. It's called Wildfire Days by Kelly Ramsey, A Girl, a Hotshot Crew in the Burning American West. She embedded with a hotshot crew in California and wrote about the day-to-day experiences, along with her personal journey just getting through life. But it's especially eye-opening for people that don't know much about firefighting and the hotshot crew. All pseudonyms, because she happened to be in my son's crew, but she used all pseudonyms, especially for the U.S. Forest Service that she worked with. But interesting story and the personalities and
what's
the determination.
What's the title?
It's called Wildfire Days. A girl, a hotshot crew in the burning American West. It's nonfiction, and her name is Kelly Ramsey.
All right, Barbara, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm always interested in, you know, the wildfire fighter. I mean, that is grueling work. I mean, you know, we go into a house fire and hopefully we knock it down, do some overhauling, and a couple hours later we go back to the firehouse and share stories about it. But, I mean, these folks are out there all day long and just brutal work. So this would be an interesting read.
Barbara, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking today with Greg Rentz. Gregory Lee Rentz and his novel is the second in a line of firefighter novels. This one's titled Beyond the Flames. Join in with your own thoughts or questions. The number is 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Our book club selection for this month is titled Beyond the Flames. Our guest with us in the studio, the author, Gregory Lee Rentz, who had 28 years on the Milwaukee Fire Department, retired as a captain, and decided to write a book, a novel, about, in part about his experiences and to portray the life of a firefighter in some ways. And I hope you'll join in. You can email us to talk@WPR.org or call us 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Dennis in Two Rivers emailed, interesting question here. Do readers of fiction primarily want to escape life or confirm their lives are valid? Dennis imagines many readers seek relief from tension or drudgery from what they choose to read, while other readers want reassurance that their lives are normal.
You know what? I think you're right on it. I mean, people read for different reasons. And I think for me, at least in my first two books, the power of fiction was opening eyes to, say, the inner city of Milwaukee, for one thing. The challenges of, say, a white firefighter serving the inner city of Milwaukee. And especially in the first book, young Mitch, he's in over his head. He's a young farmer. He's never been around that kind of violence and crushing poverty. So I actually had one lady come up to me after a book talk on my first book and say, you know, those all I knew about those people in Milwaukee were what I read in the newspaper and saw on television. I thought they were horrible people. How do people live like this? Then she said, then I read your book. She said, I had no idea these kids were growing up in such challenging situations. Now, this was an older lady still living on a farm, lived on a farm all of her life. And she said, I realized I had no right to judge these people. You really opened my eyes to what that environment is like. And I thought, that to me is the power of fiction, whether she's reading it for, you know, get away from things or, you know, to learn things. I think we always learn stuff no matter what. If you read a book, you're going to learn something from it. And I thought, this is powerful, you know, powerful stuff to be able to have people read something, take them into the life. And I think if it's written well, you're not just reading it. You hopefully you're experiencing it with the protagonist, and you're feeling those feelings, you're smelling those smells, and if you incorporate all the sensory, the five senses, you know, you're going to pull people right into that scene where they're actually almost living it right with the characters. And to me, that's the power of fiction, because there's no other art form that incorporates all of the senses like reading can if it's written well.
Somebody has shot an email wondering if they should read your first book first and then read this one, or if this one is standalone. I think it's kind of standalone.
It is standalone. Librarians have said it's kind of a follow up, but there are threads that'll carry from the first book to the second book. So if you read the first one, the second one is actually going to be a little bit more powerful for you. So yeah, I definitely suggest reading the first one and then going right to the second one, because there will be a few things in the second one where you're going, oh my gosh, that come back from the first one. And it's not something that if somebody were just to read the second one, it is standalone. The story carries itself, but there's things in there. It's just like, you know, in any series, you get to know the characters and you get to know them really well. Like in the first book, I can't lay them all out like I laid them out in the first book, because that would take way too much time. So, yeah, read the first one.
Yeah, you got Mitch is in the second book, and Jasmine, I think.
Yes. Miss Burney. Well, in fact, I should mention Miss Burney. I always ask, who's your favorite character? And especially in the first book. Everybody loves Miss Burney. In my first draft, she was just going to be a walk-on character. She's an older black lady that's Mitch's landlady. Well, she becomes his mentor, and she actually kind of took over the story big time, and everybody just loves Miss Burney. And I had beta readers initially when I started writing those scenes, and she was just going to be a walk-on, just be his landlady. And my beta reader said, I want to know more about Miss Burney. She's got to be more of a part. And that's how this writing gig goes. It's like you latch onto something and away it goes.
Well, and you do get into some a lot of things that are evil. And probably a lot of it based in part on your experiences in Milwaukee, but they're difficult. So there's rape involved, there's gangs, couple of gangs,
human trafficking. Yes, I mean that's definitely an issue, and it's still out there today. Well, we're hearing it on the news all the time. So I wanted to incorporate that all. And to me, the interesting part of this was, when I'm reading really good dramatic fiction, I find that good guys doing bad things and bad guys doing good things really ramps up the drama of a story. So, you know, Lee does some stuff in there that's kind of over the top. I mean, and then, of course, you have the inner city gang that they're kind of bad guys, but yet they're instrumental in the story. And so they're doing some good things. So that was kind of the balance there to switch it up a little bit.
Yeah, Richard emailed to mention the challenges faced by smaller isolated fire departments in communities such as Northern Door County, volunteer firefighters. And we're going to be talking coming up at the top of the hour about how about firefighters and their training. And a lot of course, a lot of the volunteer firefighters, 80% of the firefighters in the state are volunteer. But Richard says, if you're somebody, you're in Door County, for example, volunteer firefighters not only face fire and other tragedies, they are also involved in their communities.
You know, it's like I have the highest respect for the volunteer firefighters. I see the training that are in Lake Mills that our local volunteer firefighters go through every Tuesday, and keeping up though your Firefighter One and all the stuff, the EMS work and all that. I am just in awe of these folks, the dedication they have. And the bottom line is, yeah, maybe we get more fires like in Milwaukee, but a single fire is still as challenging as anywhere. And I always thought their job was a lot tougher because as a volunteer, when you pull up, you don't know who's coming with what rigs, what resources you have. Whereas like in a big city like Milwaukee, you have the Army coming in within a couple of minutes. You got three engines, two trucks, two chiefs. You got an EMS, probably a paramedic unit if there's trapped occupants. Those are all coming in behind you. So when you make a decision to go into a house, like without your backup, like I kind of did in rescue, you know that shortly that you can put it on the line like that because you got backup coming in real soon. Now, volunteers, they pull up to a house fire and maybe there's people trapped. They got to make those same decisions without the resources we had. To me, that's a heck of a lot more challenging than what I did. So I have the utmost respect for volunteers and so glad that they dedicate themselves.
Another person who read the book wonders, you talk about sort of tension between the police department and the fire department. Is there really that kind of stickiness between the two?
Yeah, there can be. There can be. It's, well, you know, years ago on the fire in the city, there was, oh gosh, we went on strike because the police at that time had gotten like a 7% raise and we weren't going to get it. So there's that competition that comes in. And, you know, there's always that thing, too. It's like when we're at a fire or an EMS scene, our number one priority is putting the fire out, making sure it's out, and, you know, taking care of the EMS person. And if it's a big gang thing, it's like the police are really working, you know, they're still concerned about the patient. But like in a fire, especially if it looks like it's arson and maybe some people lost their lives in it, they want us to kind of shut it down as fast as they can so they can get in and investigate it. Whereas we tend to want to make sure the fire is totally out, so we overhaul and probably destroy their evidence. So we're kind of at odds there, even though we both want the same thing. So there is some of that. Not to the level I might have portrayed in the book.
Well, we're almost out of time. We got about 30 seconds left. Oh. And I know you're going to be up. You'll be speaking in November.
Yes, Southeast Wisconsin Festival of Books. You can Google that and look it up. There's a Friday and Saturday event, and it's a wonderful thing for readers and writers. So I'll be talking on November 8th, and it's at Carroll University Rankin Hall from 2 to 3. And I'll be on a panel talking about
writing, I assume.
Writing, right. How do you put internal struggles and external struggles on the page?
Well, Greg, it has been a real pleasure talking with you today. I enjoyed your book, and I'm glad you could come and be with us today. The book, Beyond the Flames, a novel, Gregory Lee Rentz, the author. And hopefully you'll have another book, and we'll get him back. Coming up, we're going to talk about training for firefighters. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.